Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is January 10th, 2013. It's our first precious metals market report of the year, and I'm Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. A great wrap-up last week. If you haven't had a chance to listen to it, I can't recommend it enough. The transcript will be ready by the end of next week. We're going to take extra care and time with this wrap-up. So as soon as the transcript's done, I strongly recommend you take a look at it. And even if you had the chance to listen, I think reviewing the transcript is great background to helping give you some perspective on where we've been and where we're going. Let me just touch base before we start on some upcoming events. I'm doing a panel with Kimberly Carter Gamble, the producer of Thrive in Los Angeles, on February 10th. You can find out more about it. It's that February 10th is a Sunday, and it's early in the morning. It'll be interesting to see who turns out in Los Angeles. Then in April, I'm going to be in Portland. Our next Soleri Report subscriber lunch is with me on April 27th in Portland. And then we have a financial salon in Santa Monica with C Lane on May 4th. And then the next scheduled Soleri Report subscriber luncheon after Portland is going to be in Warsaw, Poland on June 22nd. Great announcement. We have retained a wonderful cartoonist, Bob Parsons, from Alaska to do, we're calling them Soleri Tunes. And he's going to be doing cartoons every month for us. He did a wonderful cartoon for the new Soleri Special Report, Plumbing Clean Beyond the Fiscal Cliff, and it's up on the article and up on the blog. Check it out. He's wonderful. And I know because I've been reading him for years in The Money Changer, and it was Franklin Sanders who, as we were doing the search for a cartoonist, said, you know, you ought to use Bob. And so special thanks to Franklin for that one. Tonight, as I said, the Precious Metals Market Report, our theme is You Never Know. And surprises in the air, you should expect the unexpected. It really underscores the expression that the new world is percolating. We have McDonald's now opening restaurants in Australia with a different name, Macca's. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But when McDonald's tells you it's time to look like you're decentralizing and going local, there you have it. We had one of the new crowdfunding sites, Mosaic, out of Oakland, California, in its first 24 hours fund four solar projects to the tune of $300,000. The story is up on the blog. My prediction is that as crowdfunding rolls out this year, particularly after the SEC promulgates their regulation, there's a tremendous amount of sort of new economy that wants to be happening, and I expect to see a lot of money rolling through that platform and a lot more surprise to be in the air. Money and markets. Number one story of the week, the gun control beatdown is on. We see a squabble back and forth between Alex Jones and a variety of the internet media with CNN Piers Morgan. A petition got started on the White House website to throw Piers Morgan, or pull his, he's a British citizen, pull his right to be in the country. Alex Jones was one of the people promoting it, and sure enough, Alex Jones got an invite to be on CNN, and apparently, I didn't watch it, got thrown off the show. I watched a little bit. He was quite bombastic. Alex has never been trained to perform in that environment, which really... One of the things you're trained for national network TV is it's more important to appear coherent and calm than what particularly you say. Alex was followed up by Larry Pratt, Gun Owners of America head, who did a very good job. We'll put that video up on the blog. But the clear effort on the part of the major media is to make people who support gun ownership look like they're nuts or crazy or not... you know, sort of not with it. But the beatdown is on. We saw two mysterious deaths of very popular supporters of gun ownership. One was the guy named Ratliff, who ran a very popular YouTube channel. Another, Noveski, who made guns and posted a school, sort of an article about the connection between school shootings and psychiatric medicine on the website. Very... suspicious question of what happened to those two gentlemen. We see Vice President Biden leading the campaign with sort of looking to bring forward recommendations for the president's task force. He announced yesterday that they didn't really need legislation. They could do this by executive order, which I question seriously. Meeting then with faith leaders, he's clearly building support for this. And today the announcement was he met with the NRA, who's been strangely silent. And I suspect the reason why is that the NRA has been waiting to see the specifics of what would be proposed before they really came in out and hit hard. Another story, CalSTR is announcing that it's pulling investment from gun companies. The story is up on the blog. It makes you really wonder, you know, since they financed the entire housing bubble, where do they, you know, where is this really going? This CalSTR is deciding to vote with their money. As I said before, NRA has been strangely quiet until today when Biden showed their hands. And I suspect the NRA knows that this is a very dangerous kind of situation. Wouldn't surprise me if the pressure on them is quite extraordinary. Now, what does this all have to do with the fiscal cliff? Because it has a lot. We have a new study from Heritage that I will post on the blog tomorrow. Let me just read a quote from the abstract. From 1988 and to 2001, the amount of the U.S. population that receives assistance from the federal government grew by 62%. That means that more than 41% of the U.S. population is enrolled in at least one federal assistance program. To make matters worse, per capita expenditures on recipients are rising as well. In 2010, over 70% of all federal spending went to dependent creating programs. It goes on. As Congress meets and argues about who's going to get cut, is it going to be the creditors? Is it going to be the military? Or is it going to be domestic spending and all the people who are getting a check? I think it's a real prediction of where things are going, that there's a real push to get gun control. And that push is not about about people shooting people. It's the real fear that the government can't enforce spending cuts and tax increases without getting gun control. So it's not a good sign, but very directly connected to the fiscal cliff. Second story in the news is the cabinet turnover. We see Chuck Hagel announced finally as senator, former senator from Nebraska, going in as Secretary of Defense. Hagel has a very interesting background. He's got military experience as a senator and in government, in business, academia, and investment, a lot of financial experience. And if you look at his resume, he's almost uniquely qualified to sort of sit at the nexus of the central banking warfare machinery. Then we still don't have announced John Kerry for state, but that's expected. And then John Brennan, someone with tremendous years at the CIA, lots of experience in covert operations, big proponent of drones, with quite a nasty reputation going in as head of the CIA. Jack Lew, the president's chief of staff, a very political choice going in and announced as Secretary of the Treasury. This is a very unusual pick and almost, I would say, an ominous pick. The Secretary of the Treasury was always somebody who had respect on the global stage. Traditionally was somebody who'd been very successful in business and finance. Geithner, leaving as Secretary of Treasury, was the first person chose who didn't fit that background. Rather, they were from a staff background, very much sort of the staff guy who worked for the players, but never a player himself. Jack Lew is the sort of second staff kind of person, and he's someone who can manage the machinery in a very politicized operation, not a lot of financial background. In combination with Brennan, you get the feeling of people, both Brennan and Lew are people who know how to manage the machine in a dirty world. And it almost communicates that the president and the people running the government don't have any taste for another Paul O'Neill problem. Paul O'Neill was the Secretary of Treasury who went in first Secretary of Treasury under the second Bush, former head of Alcoa, very respected and capable person with experience at OMB and in government in past administrations, but basically was a straight shooter and clean, wouldn't run it dirty, and had to go. And so instead of getting a Paul O'Neill and somebody who would have to learn the agenda, they want people who can continue to implement the current agenda without an interruption and manage, as I said before, manage the machine in a dirty world. So in one sense, it's very ominous choices, but it means the machinery will dance to the political tunes. A lot of talk now coming out of the fiscal cliff negotiations that the debt limit is very close. One report that we hit it on December 31st, $16.4 trillion, and that the Treasury is already operating on emergency measures, but it's clear that we're going to hit that limit somewhere between February 15th and March 15th when the corporate taxes are due. The new Congress coming in has got a lot less political reason to negotiate compromise between Democrats and Republicans than the last one. So we have every reason to expect a sort of very partisan squabble over both spending cuts and the debt limit. So as I said before in the wrap-up, beware the Ides of March, this could get quite ugly. We have a new academic study on Social Security saying that we're going to run out of money much faster than has been predicted. That's up on the blog. And if you look at the science of actuarial studies in government, there's tremendous latitude both in how you cook the books or what could really happen. So could it be possible? The answer is yes. New heavy push for flu vaccines with the flu season upon us. I just want to caution you, beware. We have Alan Phillips scheduled to come on later this month. He's an attorney who's done marvelous work on determining how to assert exemptions for vaccines. I'm always reminded of the story I was at the grocery about 6 years ago when one flu vacciner was being pushed. And there was a guy working at the store, helping everybody to their car with their groceries. He must have been in his mid to late 70s. You know, he's trying to pick up some extra money. And he said to me, "Are you going to take the flu vaccine?" And I said, "No, I never take them." And he said, "I never take them either." He said, "My parents taught me." He said, "Do you know about the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918? And I said, "Yes, of course, because my grandmother, my father's mother, in fact, died during the Spanish flu epidemic." And he said, "You know, the only people who died were the ones who took the vaccine." And that's what I call old-timey knowledge, but you'll hear that from a lot of old-timers, and he and I are of the same mind when it comes to vaccines. Final story, and I'm going to talk a lot more about it with Franklin, is the beginning of the reinflation. We saw a whole series of stories this week about banks settling with literally in the billions. And these deals are complicated. They run between the U.S. government and the Department of Justice, Fannie, Freddie's involved. We have other deals going down between AIG and the Department of Justice, AIG agreeing not to sue, join the shareholder suits against the government. But what all of these are about at the end of the day in the background is clearing out the criminal liabilities that resulted from the mortgage bubble. So let me just go back and recap history. Strong dollar policy, we bubble the economy with huge amounts of fraudulent mortgage and other fraudulent debt paper, suck huge capital offshore, the capital sitting offshore. Now, how do you bring it back in and reinflate the real estate and the economy after the banks and the private parties have gotten a hold of it for very, very cheap? Well, before you can do that, you've got to clear the criminal liabilities. As I said about QE3, with the Fed buying all that paper, they're running a shredding operation over there. And these subsequent deals and the bank settlements put us in the position where they can reinflate. But reinflate, remember, with a whole series of very concentrated positions in real estate and land. And now when you reinflate, it's going to make some people very, very wealthy. So what we're watching is the sort of the cleaning up after the bailouts that makes it possible to proceed with the next phase. And I think that's very important when we talk about what's ahead for the markets, including the precious metals market. Our hero this week, we have two. The first hero is a team, and they will go unnamed, and that's the Solari team. There is a wonderful group of people who run all the different operations for the Solieri reports, including servers in multiple countries. And this, over Christmas holidays, we were juggling, the team was juggling an unprecedented number of family deaths and illnesses while producing the wrap-up and the Fiscal Cliff article. And not surprising, just as the Fiscal Cliff article went up, what happened? We started to get hacked and attacked. Same with the wrap-up. I once estimated that my overhead, it was increased by approximately $100,000 a year for the privilege of trying to tell the truth. And, you know, I believe, frankly, that that's a reasonably accurate number. But this team managed to keep things operating very smoothly with only one interruption when Solieri went down the other night. I apologize to you if you were caught in that. But they've done an absolutely remarkable job under very, very great pressure, and I'm very proud of them. So please never say, why is there no one doing anything? Because I assure you there's an outstanding group of people here at the Solieri Report who are doing a great deal. My runner-up, believe it or not, is a Frenchman. So I think this is the first Frenchman who's been a hero on the Solieri Report, Gerard Depardieu, who was awarded a Russian citizenship by Putin so that he could get away from taxes in France. But he is apparently renouncing his citizenship, screaming about taxes. And I doubt he's going to be the last one to leave France or many other countries over taxes. So those are our heroes for the week. Ask Catherine. I'm going to defer our questions so that I can do them with Franklin. We're going to focus, of course, as we usually do, on the Precious Metals Market Report. We've already got some good questions in the instant teleseminar, so I would encourage you to post your questions. So I am in Western Tennessee, but Franklin has been off traveling around the nation with his lovely wife, Susan, and he is in Chattanooga. Are you with us, Franklin?
I suffered tonight at one of the best restaurants in the country and the world, and that is the Boathouse in Chattanooga. It is so unique. It's not like any place you've ever eaten. And Lawton is just an entrepreneur who's been doing this all his life, and it was just fabulous. We had supper with him and his wife, Karen, and just if you ever get to Chattanooga, you have to eat at the Boathouse.
Well, you know, the last time I was in Chattanooga, I did eat at the Boathouse. With you. And it was wonderful. You know, Chattanooga is a town I think is one of the great cities of America. It's
you know, they've done a lot of work in recent years to restore the downtown, and they have a lot of great restaurants. They have the best aquarium I've ever been to anywhere in the world. And it's just a really interesting place. But it's an example of what you can do with a local economy just with a little effort. And, you know, the thing is, I mean, I know that we concentrate on all of the losers in the world, you know, the people who are sucking off the government and so forth, and all the clowns in the government who are trying to steal from us and make life impossible. But the fact is that a lot of people like Lawton Haygood out there, who are, you know, it doesn't matter. Nothing stops them. They just keep working. It doesn't matter
right. How
bad the atmosphere becomes. They just keep on working away. And, you know, I think every one of us ought to be thankful for folks like that.
Well, you know, I think Chattanooga is an example of what happens with real leadership locally. Because I remember when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I knew some of the people who'd been involved. You had a group of local families get together and say, what do we, you know, the economy's changing. What do we need to make Chattanooga a wonderful place to be? And they went to work over many, many years and invested a great deal of time and their personal time and money to really sit down and say, you know, what are the 100,000 things that make a place wonderful for everybody? And I think Chattanooga is one of the great examples in the country of local leadership. So I'm excited that you're enjoying it. Okay, so Franklin, Just bring us up to date on the market since we talked last. How's the market doing?
Well, let me answer that question obliquely by answering how I'm doing. And I use myself the same way miners used to use a canary in a mine. You know, they would take a canary down in the mine with them because if the canary keeled over and died, they knew there was too much methane in the mine and they had to get out. And I think I'm kind of the canary in the mine. And so I've learned to watch myself and start to keel over. I know something's going on. I think the situation today is a lot like the situation was in December of 2008 or January of 2009. We had to a terrible bottom in the gold market, gold and silver, in November. We didn't know that was the bottom. Gold was at 705, went as low as 880. Now, those are the paper prices. The physical prices never went that low. And it looked like, you know, the end of the world. Stocks kept on going down from then until April, I think, when they bottomed. And it was just scary, Catherine. There's just no other way to put it. It was just completely frightening. And I found myself having to force my reasonable mind onto the situation and onto my emotions, because my emotions said, run for cover, there's nothing you can do. And my better mind said, no, you're in the middle of a bull market, and you've got to go with that. And these are the kinds of terrors that periodically pass over bull markets and make us think that they're over. And it's nothing more than the bull trying to shake off as many matters as possible. And I've really been thinking about this a lot and struggling through it, trying to get my mind right, because we've been in a correction since August in both gold and silver, since the 1st of October. And it appears they have broken out of their long corrections, and indeed they have, but they've come back in this correction. And I sent you some charts, and I specifically sent weekly charts because that's a longer term view of the market. And if you look at the weekly gold chart, you see it's okay. There's nothing, you know, nothing's happened. Gold could go down to 1500. And actually nearly 1,400 and still remain in the same uptrend that it has been in since 2001.
Franklin, I just wanted to mention, we have three charts up on the blog that are 10-year charts, and the charts that Franklin's referring to will be up on the blog by tomorrow morning and will be in the transcript. Okay? Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was late, a little late getting them to you, but if you look at the monthly silver chart, you see the same kind of pattern. You see that we've come down to the bottom of the channel, of the trading channel, haven't broken through. And even sometimes, you know, markets break through that bottom line for a little bit. You can see they did that in 2008. And it is frightening, but you have to keep reminding yourself, our strategy is not to trade in and out with daily or even monthly or even 6 monthly trends. What we're doing is we're riding a long-term primary trend, and that's where our profit is. And we have to ask ourselves, has this long-term primary trend changed? And the answer is no, because the drivers have not changed. And I probably say this every time we talk on the on the Solari program, that you have to keep going back to these fundamentals and asking yourself, did I make a mistake? Has anything changed? And the answer is no. And you've just seen that in fiscal cliff, ridiculous fiscal cliff farce. They didn't change anything. they can't change anything. You mentioned just a few minutes ago how many people, somewhere over 50% of the people, take their income from the federal government? You know, I mean, the institutional structure is such that the inflation is built in, and therefore silver and gold will continue to rise. And as scary as it gets sometimes when you get these, you know, deflation scares, or it appears that things have turned, you still have to keep looking and asking yourself that one basic fundamental question: what drivers have changed? And if the drivers have not changed, then the trend hasn't changed. So,
well, you know, I look at things much more politically. So I tend to look at economic warfare more than the charts. And I think the big question for me was what caused the down in December. And my assessment is, you know, I think the Department of Justice made a deal with HSBC to knock the price down. I think that was part of the settlement over the money laundering, because you have the announcement in the, you know, that morning and that day, suddenly massive sales of gold. Well, who is HSBC? They're the custodian for GLD. So, you know, I think there was a real intervention, and my guess is that it was critical to getting the fiscal cliff deal negotiated. So, but I think, you know, if you look at all the different tea leaves, Franklin, well, let me step back, because I don't want to get ahead to 2013. Let's just go back. And let me just say to everyone, I went back and took a look at what my predictions were for the 2012. And I have to tell you, I was not right. Because I said I thought the precious metals market was going to clearly outperform the equity markets. And this is the first time, you know, we're talking about gold as though things were tough in 2012. We have to remember that they were up. Gold, depending on which numbers you use, was up 4 to 7%. So, you know, we did get a positive return. So we're so used to positive returns, Franklin, that I think, you know, there's some markets where if you get 4%, you're thrilled. But this is the first year that, you know, if you go back and you look at the 10-year chart, and that's why I put it up, the gold and precious metals has so outperformed the equity markets, you know, whether it's U.S., Europe, even Asian, so outperformed. It's mind-boggling the extent to which they've outperformed. But this was the first year they didn't. And I think that's kind of what's got everybody shaking their heads. And me too, because, you know, I went back, I told you this last year, I went back and I said, over the last 12 years, there's been a pattern of being up double digits every 2 year and then up single digits. So this is the first time we've only been single digit on gold 2 years in a row. And I guess my sense of the thing is that a lot has been going on behind the scenes to clean up the financial coup. And they don't want to see inflation until after that's, you know, they're in a position to let what they own now rise. And I see a lot of movement to get that moving and done. And so to me, I think there is a lot to say that we're going to be looking in reinflation, and where the big question mark is for me, because I said stock market have trouble in 2012 with precious metals outperforming. I said it'd be 2000 by the end of the year, and clearly was wrong. It was approximately 1650. My big question going forward is, will they let precious metals run too far ahead of the equity markets? Because to keep the game going, they can't afford for the bond market to unravel, which means they can't afford for the stock market to unravel. So I think there was a real effort coming into the fiscal cliff deal to get the precious metals market, which had really, you know, was way ahead of equities and would have outperformed equity for the year, sort of back in the tent. And I think that's the big question in 2013, is can the central bankers manage it in lockstep with the other markets?
Well, by the, just a footnote to that, they did all of that between the end of November and the end of December.
Right.
Almost all of that move came in that period of time. I think that the stock market has another problem from my standpoint, and that is if you look at a very long-term chart of the stock market, you see a gigantic shoulders formation in not just in the U.S. stock markets, but in all world stock markets. And the downside targets on those, you know, the measuring rule for head and shoulders top is to take the height of the head and apply that to the breakout point of the neckline. And if you do that, you get ridiculous targets. You get zero targets, basically, or below zero targets, which is extremely disturbing because it implies that there's some sort of catastrophe out there. And I'm not making this up from some preconception. I'm just talking about what the technical pattern describes. And so in the last 5 years or so, the stock market has formed a broadening top, which is also called a jaws of death formation. And it appears by March or so it will hit the top of that, the Dow will hit the top of that jaws of death formation. And once it does, I mean, it's a multi-century top. When I say multi-century, I mean since 1720. And so that would indicate a long, long period to follow when stocks will fall. In addition to that, there's the problem of the bond market that you mentioned. In the last 2 weeks, the bond market, the yield on the 10-year treasury has broken out to the upside. Now, what is significant about that? Well, what's significant about that is that the Fed's whole program has been zero interest rate policy. And one of the questions that you had sent to me that one of your subscribers forwarded was in response to my comment that the Fed does not control interest rates. And, you know, I don't think they do. I think the market does. They control things at the margin. But if masses of people in the market say, you know, I don't want to hold these bonds anymore, then they're going to start selling bonds. And when they sell bonds, that means interest rates are going to rise. And so I think that's the biggest
problem. Well, but here's the question. Because what we're looking at is we're looking at a huge upside-down pyramid of paper in the bond market, in the derivatives market. And when that money, when it leaves, it's got to go to real estate. It's got to go to the stock market. It's got to go to precious metals. You know, it's got to go somewhere. And I think, you know, I'm not as negative on the stock market as you, but if you look at the trends, one of the most positive trends in the stock market is money leaving the bond market looking for someplace to go. Because even if a long bond offers 5% yield, you're better off getting a 5% yield in a real company that's doing something real, that's not just a piece of paper. And it's a financial asset, so it's not a coin you put in your pocket, but it's a real group of people doing something that's useful. Whereas a lot of the bond paper is... So that's the big question. If the money starts to leave the bond market, where is it going to go?
Well, exactly. And that of course, would be good for the good for stocks, but at the same time, it would indicate the beginning of a flight out of the dollar, which is a whole, you know, brings with it a whole basket of other problems. So the Fed is they've painted themselves as usual into a corner where they must keep interest rates low or risk unleashing catastrophe on not just one market but all across all markets. And there's no question in my mind. I keep looking at these charts. I look at the stock, at the currency charts, the three major currencies, and the two major U.S. stock indices, and the treasury bond, the 10-year treasury yield, and gold and silver. And I watch those all the time, and they don't look right. And by what I mean when I say they don't look right, in the last 6 months to a year, they have been so filled with these jerky gaps. And markets don't usually gap. You know, gaps are, if you read some one of the classic works on technical analysis, like Edwards and McGee, you'll see them talking about gaps, but gaps are really supposed to be unusual. And yet I see them constantly in these markets. And what it says to me is that the government is manipulating markets. They're in there buying and selling to push them one way or the other. Either that or the people who are trading are so confused and so driven by the latest news item that they jump from one thing to the other immediately, and that leaves these gaps on the chart. But it's not
well,
normal.
But I would say it a different way, because if you look, I wanted to go back, because you were much more bullish on precious metals last year than I was, and I think you are right now still. You know, both of us, I mean, I think we both strongly feel that this isn't a long-term bull market, and the bull is far from over. But, you know, if you look at what we got wrong last year, we underestimated the ability of the system to manage the markets and control them and direct them. Is that fair to say?
It might be. That certainly is the most obvious hypothesis to explain the failure, because if you look at the corrections that we saw in silver and gold, you just have the... Now, it might be natural in the market, but I get the impression that somebody kept driving those markets down to that 1526 point and that $26 point in the 1526 in gold and the $26 point in silver over and over and over. And usually that doesn't happen. You know, usually if you hit
right.
a mark three times, the third time it breaks through and breaks down.
Well, I guess, you know, I've watched these folks manage the markets for a year, but never this centrally, that never this controlled, that never this blatantly. And I think the big question is, and of course, as you know, I think they want a rising gold price, because they're, you know, once you've stolen all the assets, you want to go back to a sound currency. You don't, you know, you use a fiat currency to get control, but once you get control, sound currency works in your favor. So I've always thought they wanted a managed rise. They just want to hold things together. And another way to look at what has happened with what I call the financial coup d'etat, you know, they've sucked a huge amount of money out of the machine. And one of the reasons they did it, Franklin, was they couldn't figure out a way to get the American, federal government budget on a financially responsible basis. You know, the theory being you had tremendous number of constituencies, whether powerful or not powerful, all of who just wanted their check, and nobody was willing to, you know, take responsibility for the whole. So they said, fine, we'll just pull all the money. And the way we'll pull the money is we'll issue lots of fraudulent paper, we'll stuff it in your retirement accounts and pension funds, and then you'll wake up and you're basically a contingent liability owed to yourself. You know, there's a perfect virtuous circle of phony baloney paper in your retirement pensions, and when you screw yourself, it just goes around in a big circle. So the big question has always been, what's the end game? And nobody knows what that is, but that's what we're sitting and watching, you know, all the different political constituencies coming into Washington to argue, to battle this out. And for the first time, you know, we're not going to be able to just print more paper and hand it out. So somebody's going to have to get cut, and there's going to have to be a certain amount of accountability, you know, whether it's positive or negative or smart or stupid. But for the first time, you know, it's going to behave like you have to optimize a real budget, and there's limited resources. So I kind of see one pot of money that's now $20 to $40 trillion offshore, free and clear, and another pot of paper that's all stuck and yelling at each other. And it's almost as though there's a complete divide and separation within the economy between these two pots of money. And the second pot is ready to come in and have a party. And if they decide to do it, $20 to $40 trillion is enough to keep a lot of things floating around.
Oh, yeah. Well, I confess I'm a double-minded man, and there are a lot of things that I can see both sides of, and I can't really come to one conclusion or the other. But one of the things that I think is true at some level of management is that the debt doesn't matter, and it doesn't, from their standpoint, it doesn't have to be run like a household economy, because right. a household economy cannot print money, whereas they can. And right. and the problem is that does not mean that they can just keep printing money forever, because if they go too far, then they wind up in a hyperinflation and it blows up everything. So their situation is different, but it's still limited. There are still certain natural limitations of it.
Well, what's your prediction for 2013? What do you think
okay.
we have to look forward to?
Okay, I'm going to talk about numbers only. And I ran some numbers on gold and silver, and you know that, you know what Elliott wave theory is, and I'm no Elliott uh-huh. wave technician. No, I don't know sic'em from come here about Elliott wave, just a little bit. But mainly you can see in any analysis of the way markets move that they go up in three waves. They go up one wave, down one, up the third, down the fourth, and up the fifth. And generally the third wave is never the shortest, and the fifth wave is oftentimes the very longest. And we're in a third wave now, and a third wave is never shorter than a wave. And so looking at that and thinking about that and looking at what, you know, the time frames that moves in the first wave took, how long they lasted, and the percentage moves that they made, I keep coming back to this $2,300 price by the 1st of June. And I, you know, I wish I could come up to something else, but there it is. It just shows up $2,300 by the 1st of June, and the target for this move is about $4,500. And that's just based on the first wave up, and so these prices in this wave ought to exceed the percentage gains in that wave. Now,
right.
you know, that it's just numbers. That's all I can, you know, that's the only thing I can go from is just those numbers.
Well, for a long time now, I've been looking, you know, because I have clients who've been in for a long, long time, and so they have very high percentages just because it's done so well. And for a long time, I've wanted to rebalance at 1850, and it hasn't gotten there. So I'm very keen to see 1850 by mid-March. And I think the first and second quarter will tell us a great deal about what the wherewithal of the system is to keep the price, you know, kind of rising with general inflation. And I don't know, Franklin. I'm confident that it's going to keep rising. I'm confident that we're in a long-term bull market, but I know there's tremendous political pressure to keep it somewhat in the same inflation range with the U.S. equity markets. And I don't know the extent to which they can, you know, they can keep it within that range or not. But I do think we're coming into a significant inflation, and they're looking for a lot of money in the bond market to be free to shift into other things, and real estate one of them. So I think the environment's going to be generally inflation. And as you've always said, these guys have a deep, deep commitment to inflation. So I think... Yeah. So I think if the market was free to trade, your charts would make a lot of sense. And the question is, how much can they sit on it and manage it down, you know, so that it keeps track with the other markets? And that's a big question for me. And I think we'll see a lot in the first two quarters. And of course, the big surprise we're in for, the wild card, is if interest rates shoot up. And then everybody's in trouble everywhere. So, you know, that's going to...
The Fed certainly does not want to see that happen. if the worst, you know, the worst they would accept is a slow rise in the interest rate. They certainly don't want them to shoot up, because that would hurt the stock market too. You know, I mean,
it's going to hurt, and it's going to hurt precious metals. It'll hurt everything. It'll be across the board.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean,
my feeling is if the precious metals market price were to spike up too fast, or interest rates were to spike up too fast, because those are really the smoke alarms. If they spike up too fast, I think there's war. Because I don't think these markets clear with price. As you know, I think they clear with war. So anyway, so I'll just say my goal is by the end of June, I'd be most grateful if we could hit 1850, and I think there's a reasonably good chance. But the big question mark for me is, and I hope I'm wrong, and I hope you're right. I'm rooting for you, Franklin.
Yeah. Well, let me go back to something you just said. You know, I don't think most people, I think most people do not realize that if you look at the world in 1913 or 1914, what you would see is almost an ideal world. And nobody would think that Germany would go to war with France and Great Britain,
right.
And nobody would think that they would go to war with Russia, because the system of interlocking alliances was so tight, and the threat of war so overwhelming. You know, their forces were so evenly balanced. Nobody would have expected that. Well, today, you have the European Union and everybody just hugging and kissing each other over there, and everybody's all lovey-dovey, and how could a war ever happen? Don't kid yourself. War turns around overnight. And so when you say that war would be the Trump card that they would pull out to play, I think you're absolutely right. I have no doubt.
Right, and I think we've seen tremendous covert wars going on. I mean, we have boots on the ground in the Middle East, but I think the covert warfare has risen steadily and will continue. So this could be a very violent period. And, of course, that's my chief concern. Well, let me turn to some of the questions, because we have some really good questions. One is, will the value of precious metals be threatened if we move to another type of currency, whether carbon-based or not?
No, the reason, given that there would be fluctuations, the reason that you want to buy precious metals is because they are currencies themselves. You know, they are alternatives to every other currency. So, you know, they offer us a way to carry you across currency transitions from one currency to another. So even though there might be some loss there, I don't know any better way you could do it.
Right.
I mean, maybe buy D-cell batteries or something. I don't know, but I don't know any better way you could carry value across.
To me, the big threat to precious metals is technology. If we were to get extraordinary amounts of new technology being made available, particularly that would drop the energy price, you know, dramatically, that could change the fundamentals on a lot of things, including precious metals. But I think that's certainly unlikely in 2013. Paul Craig Roberts suggests that one of the ways the Fed keeps the price of gold depressed is by naked short selling on the futures market, perfectly willing to pay the penalty for defaulting on the contract. What happens when a party sells shorts and then defaults on the contract?
Well, if they can't deliver, that they have to go buy at market price and deliver. But generally, one of the things, I hate to say this, but I have to, one of the things you have to understand is that the game is rigged. And so what the futures market often does is that when there are a lot of people, who, especially dealers, you know, on the futures market who can't deliver, then they either... They change the rules in some way so that those people are bailed out. And one of the ways they do that is by so-called cash settlement.
Right.
That is, let's
And they've done that
out.
Before.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Shit. That's the reason there's no longer a potato market. well, used to, there were potato futures, and they did that in the potato futures. What happens is they say, well, let's say you're the other, you're the long on the other side of my short, and I owe you 5,000-ounce bars of silver. And they say, well, he can't pay, and so he can just give you cash, the cash equivalent for whatever the market price is right now. Well, you and I both know that by doing that, you take huge pressure off of the physical supply.
Right.
And that's the futures markets are run for the benefit of the futures merchants. They're not run for the benefit of the public. And the public doesn't generally understand that. But they will figure out a way to bail everybody out. And this question, though, goes more to what about the government short selling? And the answer is there's more than one way to sell short. You don't necessarily have to sell short on the futures, you know, the COMEX futures market. You can sell short in the over-the-counter market just as well, or you can sell SLV or GLD short and accomplish the same thing. I mean, I'm convinced that's the way they manipulate the stock market. They don't go in and buy 10,000 shares of General Motors. They go in and they, if they want to buy, they buy the futures. They buy the spider, you know, the SPY futures or Dow futures. And when arbitrageurs see that futures price rising against the index price, then they will rush in and buy the underlying index, the underlying stocks, in order to take advantage of that little spread difference. And so that's the way that the market's manipulated. So they don't just have to sell in the futures market. But the answer to the question, I'm sorry, I've wandered. The answer to the question is they just decree cash settlement and screw all of the longs. That's right. The way it's done.
Okay. January 4th saw an early market disparity between physical prices and paper equivalents. Physical was up 1% and paper was down 1.5%. I heard you say this happens frequently. What is the cause? And on this one, he's talking about the silver market.
Right. Well, let me just say that people who think that the paper price of silver and the physical price of silver are the same are tremendously misled. The most blatant example of that occurred in the fall of 2008, when there was a 50% or more difference between the price of physical silver and the price of paper silver. Literally, you had $12 physical silver and $8 or $9 paper silver. And what we've seen in the last, since October, beginning of November at least, is a shortage of almost all low premium gold coins and a shortage of 90% silver coin that has taken the premium on 90% silver coin from a nickel underspot at wholesale to today 95 cents over spot if you can find it, and many dealers are not selling 90% silver coin because they can't, they don't know when they'll be able to buy it. In other words, these low prices have driven all of those coins into hiding, the silver coins and the small gold coins. 50 pesos, Mexican 50 pesos, that's a coin that we love to sell because it has a low premium. There are not any of them out there. 90% coin, it's the same way. So
you've seen this happen so many times.
See, what that tells me is there. I don't care what the paper price is doing. There is a shortage. And I actually hear analysts who I otherwise have respect for saying that there's no physical for silver. I don't know what they're talking about. I really don't, because in my world, when the price of something goes up, that means that there's higher physical demand for it. So when you see that disparity, what it usually tells me, if the paper price is down more than the silver price, then what it tells me is that either the nice government men are manipulating the price, or else there's some kind of panic in the market on that gets paper investors, that convinces paper they ought to sell. But it's not
Questions. We're getting a flood of questions, Franklin. Can we go longer? Okay, so historically mining stocks are very cheap right now, but analysts are divided as to their potential. Some look for a big rise, others cite high costs of mining, labor agitation, risk of government seizing newly discovered deposits, dilution of shares due to executive stock options, and new precious metal taxes as reasons why mining shares will continue to fall in value. What do you think? If already holding gold and silver bullion, what would you suggest to replace mining stocks in a portfolio?
Well, I think mining stocks are stocks, and that behave more like stocks than they are like precious metals. So if you get a big decline in the stock market, they'll go down. In addition to that, Ian McAvity, who's he's a great technical analyst who's been around since dirt, and he keeps pointing out, he points out over and over that if you look at the performance of gold and silver stock indices in the 1980s, or in the period from 1970 to 1980, they do not outperform bullion. So you're just adding an additional layer of enterprise risk into your investment when you buy gold and silver stocks or mining stocks instead of bullion.
Well, the mining stocks significantly underperformed not just gold and silver, but the equity markets. So they didn't in any way track with equities this year. They were at mining stocks. Yeah. So if you look at Tocqueville Fund, for example, is down 11% this year, versus gold being up 4 to 7%. So, and equity markets being even stronger. So.
Well, the mining stocks suffer from another problem, and that is that SLV and GLD have taken out all of the logic of investing in mining stocks. They've trumped that logic. Why would you buy mining stocks when you can get the direct kick of gold and silver by investing in the ETFs? And in
right.
a mining stock, of course, you have the added enterprise risk.
Right.
So I think that's one of the things that made mining stocks underperform for the last 10 years nearly.
Right. Although if you look at the current price now, I'm not sure now's the time to switch. They're pretty far down. Okay. Well, the value of precious metals. I've asked that one. I'm looking forward to the webcast tonight. I've recently learned about hidden gold in the Philippines, Chinese gold looted by the Japanese and then hidden in tunnels during World War II. To me, the story sounds like it could be true. I'm wondering if Catherine and Franklin buy into the story as well. And if so, what is the potential impact of these hidden treasures to the rest of the world, particularly precious metals investors?
Well, can I take a second and explain the background of this?
You bet.
Okay. I have just finished reading a book called Gold Warriors by Barry Seagraves. And if anybody wants to know about this issue, I recommend that they read that book. But basically what happened was that the Japanese, with the most brutal efficiency, looted all of Asia that came under their power. And when I say looted, I mean they had army squads who literally went door to door, gathering up all the gold, silver, and foreign currency they could get. In addition, they had criminal syndicates that they worked with. They worked with Japanese criminal syndicates that in turn worked with native syndicates in China and in other places to collect all the gold and silver they could from individuals. Add to that they ran the heroin and morphine opium trade. The Japanese ran that from Manchuria into China and into Asia. So they collected enormous amounts of gold and silver. They built these tunnels in Japan, and they used slave labor to do it, including Allied prisoners of war, Chinese and Koreans. And then they would once they got the tunnel filled, they would herd these people into them and blow the tunnels, explode explosives to to seal the tunnels and seal the workers inside. The problem with this goal is that after the war, they arrested the Allies under MacArthur, arrested General Yamashita, who was the last Japanese general in charge in the Philippines, and they couldn't torture him, but they got his driver, Major Kojima, and they tortured out of him the location of some of these caches. And then MacArthur knew about this. This was reported to Washington, and instead of making it public, what they did was they used the gold that they recovered as a fund to fund the Cold War. That is an off-budget fund, black money, you'd call it, to fund the Cold War. Now, they did the same thing in Europe with the so-called Black Eagle gold that the Nazis had gathered. There's still more caches in the Philippines that have never been recovered. Some have been recovered. Marcos recovered some, and the story goes on. But the point is that the CIA, apparently, or American intelligence, got control of gold and used it. And it's very difficult to get an idea of what amount of gold we're talking about, but clearly it is maybe as much as 10 times what the central banks of the West of the world report in reserves, and that they report about, 25,000 tons, something like that. The question that arises in my mind is, this book appeared in 2003, and I'm just suspicious enough to wonder if during 2003, when they were trying to suppress the gold price, when the United States government was trying to suppress the gold price anyway, if they would not have let something like this be published with the idea that the kernel of the story is, oh my, there's 10 times as much gold out there as anybody thought there was, and therefore don't buy gold because there's much more supply than anyone suspects. I don't know. It's who knows, which is real and which is Memorex. Who can ever tell? But the point is that there's a huge amount of gold out there. It was used to fund American undercover operations or intelligence operations all through the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and until today. And so that's the burden of the story of Yamashita's gold.
Well, the kernel of truth that I've always believed is everything I've ever seen throughout my life, Franklin, is that the secret cash, the gold is the currency for the black budget and the people trying to control and manage the world. It is the ultimate dark pool and those gold caches. So in that sense, it fits with the story. And I never told you about the evening I spent with Imelda Marcos in her townhouse in New York, did I? Someday I'll tell you that story. Yes. Yes. Okay, two comments on some of your chart comments. Gaps may be a reflection of the futures market manipulation, just a timing issue of the open close of U.S. markets. Regarding charts, looking at the correlation of the price of gold and debt, it would appear that the price of gold has to rise. So I think he agrees with us. With J.P. Morgan holding such a huge short position in controlling the price of silver, when and how can this control be broken? You want me to take that? I've never believed it's a J.P. Morgan Chase position. I think it's an exchange stabilization fund position. And if you don't understand the exchange stabilization fund, it really pays to take the time. There's a video that someone did on it that we put up on the blog. My favorite story on the exchange stabilization fund is in Christopher Simpson's book, Blowback. The exchange stabilization fund is a U.S. government fund which is managed by the New York Fed on reporting directly to the Secretary of Treasury, which is why Mr. Jack Lew's position is so important here. and but is managed by JP Morgan Chase and any other private bank anointed by the New York Fed. Remember, New York Fed is owned by JP Morgan Chase and the other member banks. And so they are acting as agent as the U.S. government. And so literally that short position is managed for the benefit of somebody who has a standing army and a nuclear arsenal. And so I don't see how that position can be broken without breaking the U.S. federal credit and the U.S. military. So that's quite a strong position. Anyway, so in Christopher Simpson's book, Franklin, they've seized the money from the Nazis. They put it in the Exchange Stabilization Fund. It's sitting in the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and the Dulles brothers are sitting at Sullivan and Cromwell and decide to use it to rig the Italian elections at the request of the Vatican. And I've often said that the history of U.S. finances since that time is a story of the different manipulations done to replenish that slush fund. But that, you know, I think that's a U.S. government position. I think the idea that J.P. Morgan Chase has that position and it can be broken is, you know, is not a feasible view of the world. And it was very interesting because we had the head of commodity, the head of the commodity markets at Morgan giving a speech, I think it was sometime last year, saying that they don't, you know, that they don't have big long positions or big short positions. And then a big brouhaha because everybody's saying, well, Morgan must be lying. I don't think they're lying because I don't think they're, you know, I think they're taking that position as an agent, not as a principal. Okay, a couple more. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, the person who charges that they have this big short position doesn't understand that nobody carries, no trader carries a big short position. You carry a flat position. And so if you've got a position that's short, what you're trying to do is work out of it all the time. So J.P. Morgan Chase certainly is bright enough to know not to carry a huge, unhedged short position. If there is a short position, it has to be the federal government. It can't be J.P. Morgan.
Right.
I mean, logically.
I'm interested in hearing if Franklin believes 2013 should be a time to sell. And if he believes that 2015.75 is a turning point for the global economy.
I don't have a date in mind. What I've got are targets in mind, and I'll be glad to share my targets with you.
Please
do. It's very simple. Whenever you see the price of gold in terms of silver at less than 16 ounces, the price of the entire Dow at less than 1 ounce of gold or 16 ounces of silver, then it's time to sell.
Oh, see, I'm a much bigger chicken than you. I'm at 25. I'll start doing it at 25. Okay, one more. One of the problems that we have with silver is that silver becomes illiquid at the top. And so I have two plans for getting out of silver before the top. The silver becomes very liquid. So my question is, will you look at the ratio to make your decision, or what exactly will be the driver that screams sell? So I'm at 25 and you're at 16. Is that okay? I always, you know, that's my, I'm traditionally, my history is I get out early.
Well, let me just point out that there's another way around that. And a way that I've just recently explored, and that is that you can put your silver in a vault, in a Comex acceptable vault. You can swap it into 1,000 ounce bars and do it that way. The other alternative is to swap into gold when the ratio is about 20 to 1 and ride out the balance of the market in gold instead of silver. So that's two ways to do it. But you can't hold the silver yourself in your own hands and expect to get out at full value at the top of the market. That would be a mistake.
Right. Or you're running quite a risk. One more question. $1 trillion platinum coin. Do you or Franklin have light to shed on this proposal? Are you familiar with the proposal, Franklin?
Oh, yes. I am.
What?
Right. I am. Yeah, I'm laughing. Because what they say is that the law is written in such a way that they can print they can mint a platinum coin with any denomination they want, but all they have to do is mint one that says $1 trillion, and the federal government deposits that with the Fed, and all its troubles are over. Well, that's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous, because that's doing the same thing that they're already doing. It's just printing one piece of something instead of, you know, a billion or a trillion pieces of something. But that idea is not going to go anywhere. I mean, they've talked about it, but that shows you how desperate they are if they...
Okay. Well, Franklin, let's turn to Let's Go to the Movies. You have not seen this, but I think it reminds me tremendously of you, so I want to draw you into the conversation. Ken Burns in 1994 made a 10-DVD series on the history of baseball. And interestingly enough, it is a wonder... If you're interested in the history of America and the United States, it's a wonderful way of experiencing the history of the country through the history of one of the sports it loves. And it's fascinating. You know, Ken Burns knows how to make a great documentary. It's fascinating. There's tremendous amount of individual people that are, you know, longtime heroes in America through the sport. And it's something that's very interesting and very enjoyable to watch. And the reason I wanted to recommend it to you is that it takes you back into a world where there was much less corruption. The corruption existed was much less evident in our day-to-day life. And I was just telling this to Franklin earlier. Before 1996, one of the most common expressions in America was, hey, it's a free country. So somebody does something crazy or stupid or something you think is wild and nuts, and your attitude is fine. Well, this is America. You know, Americans were big people. They were generous. They were open-hearted, and there was a real spirit of community. And of course, sports and baseball was one of the places where people from every different background and walk of life could get together and enjoy each other's company in a real community spirit. And you get that. You know, it takes you back and you remember that world of what it meant to really be proud to be an American, not because of who or what the government was, but because who or what the American people were. We were a people who liked each other, respected each other, and respected each other's rights and respected each other's right to speak our mind. And, you know, I can't recommend it to you enough. If you want to go back to that time and enjoy what that felt like, it was a wonderful, wonderful feeling. And Franklin, I know you haven't seen it, but I know you know a lot about the American spirit and American community. And so I didn't know if you wanted to add anything, but it reminds me a lot of what it's like to be over at a big to-do at the, you know, like going to the hoedown at the Sanders farm. And suddenly you're back in that feeling of tremendous community spirit. And, you know, the hot dogs at your place aren't cheap. They're high quality pork, but you've managed to preserve that esprit de corps for all of us.
Well, you know, you touched on something, though. The difference between, you know, I'm 65, and when I was growing up in the 50s, everything was possible, and people pretty much did leave you alone. I mean, the kind of freedoms that people enjoyed then, or even 15 years ago, when you could get on an airplane and nobody asked if you were carrying a pair of fingernail clippers or anything like that. it's a different world. It's just a different world.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was a good world. I like that world. Anyway, if you want to get a sense of what that world felt like, you want to be reminded, I recommend it. Ken Burns' DVD series on baseball. Okay, well, Franklin, we know you're over in Chattanooga. We want you to have a wonderful trip, and we can't wait to see what happens in the next month, and we'll talk to you for the February Precious Metals Market Report. Have a wonderful trip, and thank you very much. Okay, next week, Equity Overview with Chuck Gibson. We're going to be talking about secular trends in the U.S. equity markets. Franklin really teed up the issue, and so we have a lot to talk about. That one's going to be a good one. I recommend it to you. Then our coming clean for the month. Remember, coming clean is our theme for the year. We're going to be doing a coming clean each month The ins and outs of vaccine exemption with Alan Phillips. Alan's been on several years before when the swine flu vaccine was being pushed, and terrific attorney who's done a great deal to help you understand how to protect yourself from all sorts of efforts to mandate vaccines. And then the last week of the month, we have, of course, the John Rappaport. So until January 17th with Chuck Gibson, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.